Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee of the Minnesota House of Representatives for this Tuesday, January 19th. My name is Frank Hornstein. I'm the chair of the committee. And we are going to be starting very shortly on our second of two informational hearings that our guests are from the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies. The topic, transportation, the future of transportation, and particularly with a focus on the impacts of COVID. And so our first order of business, and I'll just remind members that if you want to ask a question, you can do that in the participants section of your Zoom function. We will have a similar format as we had last week, where we have a couple of presenters. And we'll take a break for committee questions and answers, then have a few more presenters, questions and answers. And of course, we adjourn at 2:30 p.m. So our first item of business is to call the roll. I will ask our committee administrator, Mr. Dan Dodge, to call the roll. And simply say present, members, after your name is called.
Chair Hornstein?
Present.
Vice Chair Cagle?
Present.
Representative Petersburg?
Present.
Representative Barr?
Here, present.
Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Representative Elkins?
Present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hausman?
Present.
Representative Heinrich?
Present.
Representative Kosnick?
Kosnick, present.
Representative Mason?
Present.
Representative Murphy?
Present.
Representative Nelson?
Present.
Representative Olson?
Present.
Representative Richardson?
Present.
Representative Torkelson?
Present.
Representative West?
Here.
There is a quorum.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dodge. Next item of business is approval of the minutes for our meeting from January 18th. Representative Petersburg, will you be able to move the minutes for the 14th?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as they're still simple, they're easy to do. I do move the adoption of the January 19th minutes.
Representative Peterson, this is a... we had an overwhelming vote of approval, Representative Petersburg, for those minutes. And thank you very much for that motion. So members, again, we hope to conclude this particular panel around 1:30 or so, and then we'll have some questions and answers. Our first presenter today is Mr. Frank Doma, Professor Doma. He is the director of the state and local policy program at the Humphrey School, and he has a variety of interests and expertise that he brings to the table. But today he's going to be talking about the issue of connected and automated vehicles. Mr. Dalma, we are so happy to have you here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that you did turn it over. Actually, you cut out just at the second. I think you were doing the handoff, so I wanted to make sure that everything is...
Yes, I'm sorry about that. I hope everyone can hear me now. I was just saying you were our first speaker, and you have a lot of different talents that you bring to us as the director of the state and local policy program at the Humphrey School. And so, Professor, we are so pleased to have you. And I did let everyone know your topic for today will be connected and automated vehicles.
Wonderful. And thank you for that introduction. With that, I will move directly to my slides. I do want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee for this time and opportunity to present. I've got my just recently learned how to put a University of Minnesota background on my own Zoom here, and like to think that that's somewhat representative of the partnership that in my 20 plus years I've been at the university between the legislature and the university, funding the university generally and transportation research specifically. I'm not sure that I would be here if it was not for some of that support, and I want to thank everyone for that. So for today, as mentioned, I will be talking about connected and automated vehicles. These are also known sometimes as autonomous vehicles or self-driving vehicles or any number of driverless vehicles. A number of other words have been used, and the definitions do vary a bit. I will try to keep it on a relatively high level so we don't have to get into those different definitions of how much the vehicle is self-driving today, but would be happy to do so in the Q&A as that may be relevant. Now, to harken back to actually the presentations from last Thursday, one of the main reasons why we are interested in connected and automated vehicles from a public policy perspective is that we continue to have an issue with trying to make our transportation system safer. I believe it was mentioned last Thursday that traffic fatalities in Minnesota are up, even though vehicle miles traveled are down in 2020. That is an increase from 2019. And also in 2019 in the United States, we had over 36,000 traffic fatalities and many, many more worldwide. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has done a study and noted that 90% of these crashes and fatalities tend to be due at least in part to human error. So to bring this to why do we worry about connected and automated vehicles, it's that if human error is causing so many of these crashes, if we can have technology help out, we can make a reduction in that, and we should. In this age of COVID, the numbers seem to sometimes get a little bit different in scale, but I'll bring this back to 36,000 fatalities in a year is the equivalent of basically a 737 airliner crashing every day. And we know we don't accept that because just two crashes worldwide grounded the entire 737 MAX fleet. And so we can and probably and should expect a better performance from our surface transportation safety record. And so that's a real reason why connected and automated vehicles may make a difference. Now, the next question is, did COVID impact the development of connected and automated vehicles? I'll be talking a bit about kind of the model that's been popular among transportation planners, that we would deploy these technologies in a way that is shared as well as autonomous, maybe electric, and indeed people have become more skeptical of sharing rides, transits down, so on and so forth. But by just this last month, we saw an influx, a great increase in activity just from the private sector side of announcements of breakthroughs and new partnerships and so forth going forward, some of which I'll also talk about in more detail. And then just last week, the USDOT got back into the act at the beginning of the week, introducing the Automated Vehicle Comprehensive Plan, which is kind of the latest statement of several statements that they have done talking about guidelines, encouragements, goals, and principles that should be followed in the development and deployment of vehicles using this technology. And then specifically, NHTSA issued a new rule on safety standards, pointing out that they are recognizing that while it's very important to have, for example, a steering wheel in a vehicle that is driven by a human, that steering wheel may be redundant in a vehicle that does not have a human driver, and even possibly useless. And so they would not necessarily require a steering wheel, but they will require other steps to ensure that these vehicles are indeed safe. Now, the federal government has traditionally been regulating the vehicle, and states regulate the drivers. So it's worth looking at what's happening in Minnesota. And a number of times I receive questions about when I'm making this presentation is, when will we see this technology come and become something that we can encounter on a regular basis? And I first got that question back in 2017 that I got quoted widely. This was from the Star Tribune. And my basic statement is, if I gave you a date, it will probably happen earlier. So we can use that as sort of a rule of thumb. My other line is that, you know, I've got a colleague in this sort of research who has talked about self-driving vehicles being 20 years away for the last 80 years. And I've put my corollary on that, that it's probably going to be 5 years away for maybe the next 20. And then today, I will say that it's possible that we actually may encounter this technology within even this year. In certain ways, if you're paying attention. So keep your eyes open. I think there'll be some things that could be quite interesting. Now, what's happened in Minnesota specifically, again, that quote I showed came from 2017, 2018, when MnDOT brought an automated shuttle bus into Minnesota. They were among the first to test that technology in winter weather conditions, and they did so at the MnRoad facility out towards St. Cloud. It was also the year the Super Bowl was here, and so they did a public demonstration on Nicollet Mall, got some attention that way. We had it on campus in April of 2018. It also did some demonstrations down in Rochester. Not long after that, the legislature did allow some platooning, which is a very sort of low-level application of this technology for freight vehicles in particular, allow testing of that to happen on Minnesota roadways. And in the meantime, both Governor Dayton and now Governor Walz have had advisory councils on connected and automated vehicles, which I've had some involvement in. I'm currently co-chair of kind of a subgroup that's looking at data and connectivity issues, which I'd also be happy if anyone has particular questions about that to discuss in the Q&A. My real point today, though, is I want to talk about the way we're seeing these vehicles evolve and how we will most likely see them used broadly in the near future. And that's same as this vehicle that MnDOT brought. We've seen it in terms of autonomous micro shuttles. They tend to be low speed. They don't travel more than 25 or 35 miles an hour. They don't carry more than, say, 10 passengers. And significantly, they do drive entirely by themselves. On a fixed course. There's only certain places they can drive. It usually needs to be pre-programmed, but they do not have a steering wheel or a brake pedal as we're used to. These have a number of manufacturers. They look in, slightly different, but somewhat the same. I'll point out that the vehicle on the right, the technology is from a company called May Mobility, but the vehicle is from Polaris, a good old Minnesota company. And so there is some private sector involvement in the development of these vehicles as well. And then the major manufacturers are into it. This is a concept vehicle that Volkswagen put out. Again, also this 2017-2018 timeframe. Slightly smaller than some of those shuttles, but again, we see the doors are opening to the side instead of the way we're traditionally used to car doors opening. That creates a wider opening, greater flexibility in use of the vehicle. Also, more recently, GM, in partnership with Honda, created this vehicle called the Origin. Looks very similar. And then just a few months ago, a company called Zoox put out their vehicle. The doors work the same, but this one they say is rated to operate at highway speeds, up to 75 miles an hour. And if you've never heard of Zoox, you've probably heard of their major funder, a little company called Amazon. So again, a significant investment coming from the private sector to develop this technology. And it's important, I think, that we as thinking about this from a public policy perspective as well, to be ready for these developments. One other way to think about how these can be used, this is a company called Nuro, and they don't have people in their vehicles, they put stuff in it. It's a way to deliver freight, deliver groceries even, so small packages and so forth, can be delivered without a driver and precisely from origin to destination. Again, it still looks the same as somewhat as these other ones. And that's led one observer to say that we're moving toward a self-driving car that is essentially a pod on wheels. In other words, we're seeing development of vehicles that are more flexible in their use and their shape to do a variety of things that are somewhat different than what we maybe expect from the vehicle that's in our garage. So if you're thinking the first time you'll really have to deal with automated technologies is when you buy your next vehicle, indeed, that is inching in. Tesla does that, and they're promoting it. I have some safety concerns about that, that again, I'd be happy to discuss during the Q&A. But there are lots of other opportunities where we're going to see this happen in kind of more of a fleet environment or ways that will affect us in other ways. Specifically, I think about in transit, particularly in rural areas, this is an opportunity to address what is a driver shortage. You'll be able to use these vehicles to provide rides for people who can't drive and increase the either the frequency or also maybe the service hours that you could provide rides for people who aren't able to drive their own vehicle. And then also in the private sector, new ways to handle supply chains, possibly giving a little bit of a lead into a later presentation today. But again, a COVID example over here on the lower right, I should probably apologize for using something that says Badgers on it when I'm making a presentation in Minnesota. But they actually had a bigger issue with the COVID outbreak on the University of Wisconsin campus than we fortunately had here in Minnesota. And one of the ways they dealt with it is they had these autonomous vehicles that could deliver a meal from the dining hall to the dorm. And the student would just order it on their phone and it would come to the dorm and they'd pick it up. And it's not operated by a human at all. It follows a programmed route. So as I close with my time here today, I just want to kind of give the final message that what we are seeing is that there's opportunity and really something we should take advantage of to get this technology out in front of the public so that they can understand, one, that it's real, and two, that it's going to be viable in ways that they may not otherwise expect, but it's also not going to be a recreation of the Matrix or some other dystopian scenario. With that, I'd be happy to take some questions.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Dauma. And what we're going to do is just go straight to Professor Northrup, and then after his presentation, we'll have an opportunity for Q&A, and then we'll move on from there. Professor Northrup's presentation, again, very much related to yours, so that's why we're grouping these two together. We're very, very happy to have Will Northrup with us. Professor Northrup is the Associate Professor and Director of the Thomas E. Murphy Engine Lab in the Department of Mechanical Engineering. And his topic is going to be post-pandemic transportation trends in vehicle technology. So from an engineering standpoint, building on some of the themes that Professor Dauma shared with us. So welcome to the committee, Professor Northrup. We're very happy to have you. Please state your name and title for our record, and then you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the committee members for inviting me to speak at this meeting. This is the first time I'm talking in front of this group, and I have not really met many of you, so I will introduce myself a little bit more. My name is Will Northrup. I'm Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Minnesota. I direct the Thomas E. Murphy Engine Research Laboratory, which I can bring up here, which is a facility that is located off of the U of M campus, the East Bank campus, north in the Como Avenue area. It was commissioned in 2014, and it was funded through the HEPR program. So it has enabled us to bring in over $1 million in federal and industry funds to engine and energy research for the past, I've been here, so now 9 years. So Yeah, so that is sort of a little bit background on myself. I actually have industry background, have worked in the automotive industry and kind of a gearhead, motorhead type person. Enjoy vehicles and do like the research that I do is focused on engines and now electrification. Just a quick overview of the areas that we have interest. So I'm more on the technology side than Professor Dalma. I would say that we do a bunch of hardware related work, including combustion and nanoparticle emissions. We do connected and electrified vehicles. In fact, we're bringing some electric trucks under a Department of Energy project with Volvo here in the near future to be running in a local logistics fleet in Minnesota. So for winter testing, I think that should be really exciting, as well as some biofuels work that we've done under sponsorship in part from LCCMR and others, looking at anhydrous ammonia as a fuel and other things. But what I really would like to talk to you today is about the mega trends and talking about post-pandemic trends and what we see as a emerging trends in terms of vehicles. So Professor Dalma already mentioned autonomous, and I will not be covering that, thankfully, because he did a nice job. And connected is another area that we're really looking at, and electrified. Of the mega trends that we're seeing in technology development, these three have continued through the pandemic, maybe have gone underground to some extent in terms of implementation, but they are making big strides currently. So if I continue on here and sort of talk about transportation post-pandemic, which was the question at hand, last week in the hearings, you saw that that some of these trends about private vehicle travel increasing while public transportation, shared mobility, air travel plummeted significantly during the pandemic. But you're seeing now that light duty vehicle sales, as you see in that blue line, if we look at the monthly change in transportation indexes recently kind of published, you can see that light duty vehicle sales are just rebounding, as well as vehicle miles traveled and other things that have to do with personal vehicles. So it really does appear that private vehicle sales are going to be resilient, in fact, increase after the pandemic as people may be concerned about using public transportation, et cetera. So fuel prices, of course, are a major predictor, and essentially in my field, fuel prices remain historically low, and you can see Gas Buddy is something that I always look at, and you can see that it's down to the $2.38 mark as of today or this week. Essentially, that's about, in 1960s terms, that's about still significantly cheaper of the 31 cents a gallon if you would do it for inflation adjusted, which would be $2.70 in 2020. So we still have historically cheap gasoline. So it might beg the question, why would we be interested in electric vehicle technology if gasoline is so cheap? Well, it turns out that during the pandemic, automakers have taken advantage of this to develop electric vehicles, yet the demand for electric vehicles appears to be slowing, especially in the US. So a recent McKinsey report shows that although we're at about 2.5% of all vehicles sold are battery electric vehicles worldwide, in the US, it's much less than that. And in fact, it's starting to shrink. And we're seeing that these trends are showing maybe that there might be a peak or some sort of maximum. But my personal opinion, and that's what I'm here to give you, is that this is not gonna be the case. EV technology is advancing rapidly. One of the major game changers that we'll see in EV technology that has not gotten as much press is the advancement of what we call solid state batteries. Currently, batteries have what's called a liquid or gel electrolyte, which is inside the battery pack itself. This prevents charging at a rapid rate. It's inefficient, expensive, and really difficult in cold weather performance, which is what is really of significance to us here in Minnesota. Solid-state batteries largely fix these issues, although they may not have the energy storage density that gasoline does, they can really significantly change the game with regards to EV technology. Toyota, as I'm showing here, is bringing solid-state battery prototypes in 2022. Of course, they're ahead of the game, as usual, with regards to electrification. and are really advancing this technology. They claim that you can get 300 miles of range charging your vehicle in 10 minutes, which is really significant compared to what we are where we're at now. So that's reason number one. Reason number two, we expect to see the EV trend pick up, is that there's huge investment by OEMs right now. My colleagues in General Motors R&D, who I used to work with in the engine development area, are no longer working in engine development. General Motors has shifted all of its research and development efforts towards electrification on the powertrain side. So all my friends who used to work at GM in engines, no longer working in engines. So that is a big trend. And you can see here, this is just a really busy slide, but really just shows you like the amount of activity going on and the statements made. And you know, specifically, you think about Volkswagen after the diesel crisis is now committing to 40% of global sales to be all electric by 2030. They're introducing a new model this year, which I'd like to be on the waiting list for. Two-thirds of sales of Honda, Mazda, BMW, all the majors are going whole hog into electrification. So that's something that you will see. In fact, if you just look at the market cap of Tesla, you can see where the market thinks the directions are going. So the third point that I'd like to make here is that there's substantial infrastructure investment. In fact, Xcel, the Minnesota based partially company, is moving ahead with $110 million electric vehicle charging plan, including 20,000 chargers to be located in Colorado. And I think in Minnesota, I'm not entirely sure, but I think that this is a huge trend, and these energy companies are waking up to this idea, coupled with their renewable energy plans, which are moving ahead. So these are three major reasons why I see EV technology will not be plateauing in the near future after COVID leaves us, hopefully. So the other thing I want to say is that I do run an engine research lab, and we do see a role for engines in the future. Oftentimes when you see OEMs say electrification is their strategy, what they mean is that they're going to be some mixture of engines and batteries in what we call the powertrain, which includes the engine, battery, hybrid transmission, and all these other things that are inside. So hybridization is still going to be a factor in the interim until battery electric vehicles may take over the entire market. So in the interim, we have a lot of opportunities in engines, and I do think that there's going to be some engine advancements. And in terms of fuels, I think I'd like to mainly point out in my remaining minute here that engines can reduce greenhouse gas emissions in a similar way to electric vehicles. If we consider the use of hybridization schemes, higher efficiency engines, which is still happening, and my research group, among with others, is working to advance, as well as the increase of e-fuels and biofuels, including corn-based ethanol, which is produced at a large quantity in Minnesota. And with increasing efficiencies or increasing renewability of ethanol, we can see that ethanol can still play a role, as well as some of these fuels, so-called e-fuels, which are created from renewable electricity and make drop-in replacements to gasoline, for example. So these are all factors that can play a major role in increasing renewability, and will increase the be increasingly seen in vehicles in the coming years. So with that, I just have some summary points, because I know some of you have my slides in PDF format, so you can just kind of take these as takeaway points. I'm not going to go through them since I'm out of time. But essentially, I'd like to just say that the post-pandemic transportation environment will increase personal vehicle sales. We're going to see connectivity, automation, electrification. Electric vehicles appear to be stagnant, but will not be for the reasons I noted, and that efficient engines with e-fuels and biofuels will continue to be a major role, especially up through 2040, in my opinion. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to conclude my talk and thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Northrup. That was an excellent and very engaging presentation, as was yours, Professor Dauma, both well-organized and thoughtful, and we appreciate it. I'm going to take a couple of questions here, and I would remind members, if you can't get your question answered, because we do want to make sure that we have enough time for our remaining three presenters, please email me or Mr. Howe, and we will get your question directly to the person you're directing it to and get you an answer. So I'm going to take three questions, and then we'll move on from there. In this order, Representative Petersburg, Representative Mason, and Representative Kosnick. So our first question will be from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is primarily for Professor Northrup, but the other professor can chime into it too. And that has to do around the idea that he talked about solid state batteries and batteries in general. Minnesota, as a cold weather state, has had some trouble with that. I know that autonomous vehicles are primarily all electric controlled as well. And it seems to me I've read somewhere that Met Council had some electric buses pulled off the line a little bit because when they get down to below zero, they aren't working well. Can you give us more information on just how the battery life is working and how that's impacting the development?
And that sounds, thank you, Representative Petersburg. That sounds like a good one for Professor Northrup.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, thank you for that question. Yeah, I am aware, especially in the city of Duluth, they had electric buses made by a company named Proterra in their fleet and had significant problems with cold weather performance with those buses. And one of the things that I've pitched oftentimes is that in Minnesota, we really need to be the testing ground for a lot of these cold weather batteries, because we have the environment. Maybe not so much this winter, it's a little warm, or mild, should I say. But I do think that battery technology is improving. Current battery technology, I would agree, is significantly, has a significant disadvantage in cold weather. I drive a Volkswagen e-Golf from 2015. My range goes from about 110 in the summer to about 40 when it's about, you know, in the teens outside. So it's significant. And a lot of that is due to the hit in efficiency because you're running the heater, but a lot of that is due to the battery technology. Solid state battery technology, as I mentioned in my presentation, has really potential to significantly impact this and make those transit buses more viable. So I think that maybe the nascent sort of battery tech that we're seeing in some of the vehicles now will have much less issues in cold weather maybe in the next 5 years.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg.
Can I have a quick follow-up, just very quick?
Absolutely, Representative Petersburg. Go ahead.
Thank you. So two things. In regards to the extending and growing of electric vehicles and the charging stations and the infrastructure, I don't have a problem with thinking that we can get the infrastructure in place. The concern I have is twofold. One is, how is rulemaking for clean air and stuff kind of forcing electric vehicles, and whether or not our actual electrical grid can actually handle additional power distribution issues when we're already seeing some vulnerabilities there? Just a follow-up question, and then I'm done. Thank you.
No, that's great. That's a great question, Representative Petersburg. Professor Northrup, is that one in your wheelhouse there, or Mr. Dauma, either one of you? Professor Northrup?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, I'm not an expert in distribution grids, but I have to say that I'm more of a vehicle expert. I'd have to say, though, that I know that infrastructure is being built up around EV. I know that also that there are times during the day when EV can be charged that are on, you know, during off hours or off peak hours on the grid. So if you listen to Excel, they seem to have no issues with this idea. I do have concerns that our infrastructure isn't up to par at this moment, but if we're looking at right now, like 99% or like 1% of vehicles are plug-in, if the rate of adoption is increased at a reasonable rate, I think that it's a possibility. So that's my opinion.
Thank you. We have Representative Mason, Representative Kosnick, and then I'm going to cut it off after Representative Elkins, because we need to really move on. We have three more speakers and we want to make sure they have time. So Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember being at a national conference a couple years ago when we were discussing the autonomous vehicles. And one of the concerns brought up was they would see potentially an increase in these vehicles carrying children, vulnerable adults. And the question is, how do you handle accidents and liabilities? et cetera. Is that something that is being concerned when you're dealing with the autonomous vehicles?
Professor Dalma, I think that might be a good one for you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. There is quite a bit of discussion going on regarding liability in these vehicles and who uses them. I don't believe we're at a stage that anyone who is not comfortable using them would ever feel they have to. But in a situation where someone is in one of these vehicles and it is involved in a crash, we're seeing that in most cases, the manufacturers are willing to say that they are behind their technology enough that they are willing to also accept the liability. Ultimately, I expect that we will see a move from personal liability, that is that of the human driver, to more products liability type of situations. And how that actually ends up working out, other than possibly fewer late night ads from have you been injured in a car accident lawyers, I think we'll just have to kind of develop over a little bit of time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, and welcome to the committee to the two professors. It's always an interesting topic to try to predict what the futures will bring for us in transportation. And I think the Professor Northrup's opinion and educated opinion on EV sales, even though they may seem to be stagnating, I think I would agree that they will continue to increase. And I know Representative Elkins has not only the question after me, but the bill to address some of those future trends. But my question is, you know, how is the effect that you'd mentioned, how would this affect transit and commuting, both post-COVID and the trends that you're seeing on, as you mentioned, increased sales of personal vehicles and kind of a hesitancy to crowd together on a regular bus? And if you have any suggestions, or is there research or trends that would indicate how transit will be transforming. We've kind of seen, even before COVID, maybe a little bit of a shift away from regular route service to more BRT, express, and arterial service. Is that something, is there some research that either of you have seen that would help us guide our transit system to be more efficient in terms of how we serve the riding public on some of those route transfers?
Thank you, Representative Koznick. Would either of you want, who wants to take that one?
I can jump in. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Koznick. That's another one of these sort of crystal ball questions that or an eight ball question that says, ask again later. But I think, you know, we are definitely seeing some studies coming out pointing out that in most cases, even though people are leery of taking transit, there's not a lot of factual evidence that people are at increased risk of getting sick from taking transit. And a number of best practices guides coming out to guide transit agencies. What this means over the long term, I think you're right. At least here in the Twin Cities, we're seeing some greater emphasis of higher capacity trunk lines. And in my opinion, the opportunity here is that we can see these automated shuttles begin to sort of serve as, if you will, collectors for people in lower density areas, not like downtowns, but suburban neighborhoods and so forth, that can get people from their home to those higher capacity lines and be able to address what we refer to often as that first mile, last mile question.
And Representative Koznick, when Professor Dalma said ask again later, I think you can ask that again later on Thursday, because we have three different transit agencies coming to the committee. And I had asked them to basically respond to your very question. So, you know, that will be certainly a topic among other topics that we deal with on Thursday. So thank you. Our last question.
I hope that our experts here today, that their informed opinions will gel with the request of our transit agencies.
Well, there's always a lot of important data coming in from a lot of places. And I know there has been, I think, some collaboration in the past between CTS and Met Council and other other transit folks in the state. So, but we will definitely be interested in further conversation about that, Representative Koznick, is 48 hours from now. Representative Elkins, you have the last question here from the committee for this particular panel. Go ahead, Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you. It's more of a an answer Mr. Petersburg, Representative Petersburg's question about the grid. And so I've been in conversations with Xcel recently on this question, and they point out, first of all, that at least right now, the vast majority of the EV charging is happening in our homes at night when it's off-peak hours, and there's very little demand on the grid. In fact, right now, if you're charging your car in the small hours of the morning, almost all of the energy that's being used is being generated by a combination of wind and nuclear right now at very low cost. I get to charge my car for about 4 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour, and it costs practically nothing. The question is on their radar. They are worried about, you know, what happens if what would happen if there were spikes due to charging. But if, as long as most of it is being done at night, that's not an issue for them at all. Like, one of the largest issues that is looming in terms of getting more adoption of electric vehicles is that at least at present, most multifamily housing does not have facilities for overnight charging for the residents. And that's going to be something we have to address over the next decade or so as well. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Members, we're going to shift now to our final speakers for the day. And we're going to be dealing with a lot of, conversation about, first we're going to deal with supply chain issues. And I mentioned last week when I introduced the panel that, really transportation workers and transportation infrastructure in general has really kept us afloat in many ways during the pandemic. We have seen transit play a key role in moving our frontline workers to their jobs. We'll hear a little more about that on Thursday, but also our supply chains, particularly our freight supply chains, have been so critical in, making sure that people have basic services and whether it's food or a variety of different essential services, transporting the medicines that we need, the vaccine. It's all about the transportation supply chain. And we have an expert in that particular area. His name is Karthik Natarajan. And Professor Natarajan is an assistant professor at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. And he will be speaking to us about the impact of COVID-19 and the future of supply chain transportation systems. Very, very critical, very, very important for all of us to be considering and have some information and background on. So Professor Natarajan, thank you so much for coming today, and please state your name and title for our official committee record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, and thanks to members of the committee. It's my honor and privilege to be here today. My name is Karthik Natarajan. I'm a faculty member in supply chain and operations at the Carlson School of Management. So let me go ahead and share my screen here. So as the chair mentioned, so my background and expertise is in supply chains. So in this presentation, I'm going to focus on the impact of COVID-19 and how that might shape the future of supply chain and transportation systems. And in the interest of time, I'm going to focus on two key sectors for our state, namely the retail sector and the food and agribusiness sector. And then if we have some time, I'll talk about broader supply chain trends and anticipated changes. So let me start by focusing on retail supply chains. So, as we can all attest, the pandemic has significantly altered people's purchasing behaviors, right? So if you look at this graph, what we see is e-commerce and online sales were growing substantially even before COVID-19. So this is not a new trend, but what the pandemic has done is it has accelerated that trend. And it has also opened online purchases for new categories that we did not see before. And essentially what this has done is it has atomized traditional retail supply chains as the emphasis shifts from stores towards small deliveries to homes. So what are the implications of this for supply chain and transportation systems? So the first main implication that I can see is it has led to a drastic increase in small parcel volume. So for example, if you look at the global small parcel market, that is expected to more than double between 2019 and 2026. And if you look at Amazon's small parcel volume, that is expected to grow at about 30% annually every year between 2020 and 2024. The second main implication that we are seeing is the shorter transportation hauls. And the main reason behind this is more and more customers are expecting and even demanding one-day or two-day deliveries, right? So in response to this, what companies have done is they have created smaller warehouses closer to customer locations. So in fact, the average length of haul has reduced by almost 25% over the last 10 years. So collectively, these point to a significant shift in terms of both transportation modes as well as transportation hauls over the next decade. And this could lead to increased pressure on our local transportation networks because of last mile distribution. And it also has the potential to substantially increase the carbon emissions because of increase in last mile transportations. So this raises a number of important transportation policy questions. So for example, do we have the required capacity within our local and regional transportation networks to handle the higher volumes coming from the growth of online channels? And would the higher volumes and delivery time pressures justify the creation of dedicated lanes for delivery vehicles and logistics providers? And finally, for carbon accounting purposes, who would be assigned responsibility for the higher emissions? Would it be the retailers who are selling these products, or would it be the logistics providers who are actually delivering those products to customers? So in response to the drastic increase in last mile deliveries, logistics companies are also considering a number of newer technologies. So this includes the use of drones as well as driverless vehicles that Professor Duma actually mentioned before. So this is the same technology that he was mentioning. So these newer last mile transportation methods have substantial policy implications with respect to both monitoring as well as oversight. And managing the multiple last mile transportation systems will require tighter coordination between agencies at the different levels, including local, state, and federal levels. And in addition, if you look at logistics companies, they're also moving towards electrifying their fleet. So this will require substantial investments in charging infrastructure that we have been talking about. And this also raises a number of key policy questions, including taxation structure, charging fees, and things like that. So this is one area where I see substantial potential for public-private partnerships in the near future. And then finally, the growth in online sales is also likely to result in a massive increase in return volumes. So for example, data shows that the return rate for online sales is about 30% when compared to 8% for brick and mortar sales. So this drastic increase in return volumes will require investments in developing the right reverse logistics infrastructure. And this could put further pressure on our local transportation networks, and it could also lead to a further increase in terms of carbon emissions because of this huge increase in return volumes. So now let me switch a little bit and then talk about our other key industry sector, which is food and agribusiness supply chains. So again, as we all know, the pandemic has significantly altered people's eating habits, right? So essentially moving away from eating at restaurants and schools to eating at home. So as we can see from here, the demand for food at restaurants is nearly down anywhere between 40 to 60% right now. Of course, the demand is expected to rebound as we emerge from the pandemic, but many experts believe that the demand for food away from home may actually never go back to pre-pandemic levels. So essentially, a certain percentage of the demand at restaurants and coffee shops is likely to shift permanently to eating at home. So for example, if you look at General Mills, their sales was up by 16% in the fourth quarter of 2020. And it was up by 10% in the first quarter of financial year 2021. So as I mentioned before, a portion of the surge in demand for cereals and packaged food is expected to stick. So in response, General Mills has increased their investments in production and supply chain. So to meet the surge in production and demand, we will need more transportation capacity, not only for the finished products, but also for the ingredients that go into these products. But more importantly, we need to strengthen and expand our market linkages for farmers so that they can fully benefit from this increase in the demand for food at home products. So this includes creating the right economic linkages, but also creating the right transportation linkages between farmers and the appropriate markets. So in this context, we need to evaluate the capacity in our existing transportation linkages. We want to make sure that we have enough capacity in those existing linkages. In addition, we also need to explore new transportation linkages to better connect more farmers with the markets. And then finally, the pandemic has also exposed the inflexibility of our food and agribusiness supply chains. So for example, the food service supply chains typically distribute to restaurants. And then the retail food supply chains typically distribute to our grocery stores. And oftentimes what happens is these two supply chains operate in silos because of differences in product size, packaging, and the distributors involved. So this is where we saw a lot of food waste over the last summer. You know, the dairy farmers dumping their milk or farmers having to plow their produce back into the land. The main reason was these two supply chains don't necessarily talk to one another. But as demand shifts from this channel to this channel, we are likely to see substantive changes in terms of distribution patterns, available capacity, and also the transportation modes that are utilized. So this is where I think there might be an opportunity for us to revisit some of our transportation and packaging policies to make it easier to switch between these two supply chains. And that would make our food supply chains much more resilient in case of future events. So the big picture, I think the next decade will bring major changes in terms of transportation landscape with respect to transportation modes, haul lengths, role of technology in the last mile, and also the realignment of transportation networks because of the shifts in demand that we are seeing right now. And this has a number of key policy implications. So for example, managing and coordinating the traditional and technology-enabled transportation modes. So this is something that we have been talking about. The other implication is developing interagency coordination plans at the local, state, and federal levels, and also leveraging technology-enabled last-mile solutions to meet the growing demand in a more sustainable and equitable way. So with that, let me stop my remarks. Again, if you have questions, you can reach me at this particular email ID. Thank you, Jeff, for the opportunity. I'll send it back to you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Professor Natarajan. That was very, very thought-provoking and I think really provides us with a lot of important information, particularly the redefining in many ways what farm to market needs to look like, and of course the last mile distribution and some of the carbon and climate implications of this new reality that we face. So we will, again, have questions. If you have members, questions, if you have questions, we will have those after Professor Lowry and Professor Munich's presentations, which are coming up. So thank you, and we'll hang in there, and we'll have questions for you, I'm sure, in just a few minutes. Our next presenter is no stranger to this committee. His name is Adil Lowry. He is a research fellow at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. And as I've said several times when our paths have crossed over the last few weeks, I've said that Professor Lowry has been talking about telecommuting way before it was fashionable. And you know, he was a part of the Urban Partnership Agreement, some conversations we had about telecommuting, and that of course is the 35W Orange Line project. There were also some telecommuting studies done related to that, a whole new way of looking at transportation between Lakeville and Minneapolis. And so Mr. Lowry, we are so pleased to have you. I think a lot of people are interested in what you have to say about telecommuting and how that will be a part of the future transportation landscape. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your title for our official record.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman Hartstein and Transportation Committee members. Glad to have the opportunity to make presentation to some of my friends at the committee. My name is Adil Lowry. I am the research fellow at the State and Local Policy Program. So Gina is helping me to move the slides because I'm a little bit worried about my capacity of my internet here. So next, please. At the state and local policy program at Humphrey School of Public Policy, I had the opportunity to champion and with partner design, brand, implement and evaluate the largest and most successful telecommuting initiative in the country, which lasted from 2009 till a couple of years ago. The initiative was funded by state legislators. Thank you, Chairman Hornstein. As part of the Urban Partnership Agreement to the tune of $3.2 million, during which we had significant marketing and education pieces, including development of e-workplace website. The initiative later was funded by Met Council's Congestion Mitigation Initiative for Phase 2 and Phase 3. The driving force behind the initiative was the belief that we do not have to accept traffic congestion and resulting greenhouse emission. Our Phase 1, determined by a federal evaluator that the $3.2 million initiative had a return of 11 to 1. Not many transportation investments have such a high return. At Humphrey School, we have continued to keep our website alive and study telecommuting. Next, please. And then COVID-19 happened and the world went remote. There are a great number of studies trying to measure the impact of COVID-19 on the workforce and measuring the number of employees working from home. But as the definitions are varied, so it is difficult to compare the data. Just recently, Bureau of Transportation statistics found that the last October, about 43.5% of the households had at least 1% telecommuting. Met Council panel study of last May found that 48% were working from home full-time compared to 12% before. Similarly, according to Minneapolis Downtown Council, only 12.2 of 218,000 employees were coming to downtown this summer compared to February of 2020. Google Mobility report on October 9th estimated that there was 32% reduction in trip to workplace in Minnesota. This reduction was 45% in trip to workplace in Hennepin County. This is consistent with other studies which found that urban areas are experiencing higher percentage of reduction because of the type of the employment. One Federal Reserve Bank study found that 35.2% of the Americans were working at home in May 2020, compared to 8.2 in February. What I found interesting is that even now, only 71.7% of workers that could work from home effectively actually did for some reason or the other. So there is still possibility of additional workers to work from home. Next, please. Minnesota DOT calculates and reports the reliability data on metropolitan roads on a monthly basis as part of their performance measurements. Target is that the system should have travel time reliability about 90%. You can see from the two graphs that reliability rarely met those goals during 2019, but in nearly 100% since March of 2020, basically peak period volume reduction. Next, please. Traffic volumes mostly composed of commuting and discretionary trips. COVID-19 reduced commuting trips due to work from home as well as due to unemployment. Michael Acano, our ex-research assistant and now in MnDOT, has tried to calculate the effect of unemployment out of traffic count by districts. According to his calculation, Minnesota District 1 and 2, which are northern districts, experienced an increase in net volumes, while Metro District and District 8, which is the southwest, experienced reduction in travel net of reduction caused by reduction in employment. I believe it also reflects significant increase in telecommuting. Next, please. But we found that working from home is not for everyone. There's a difference between workers who can work from home by race. Hispanic and Black workers have much lower percentage of the jobs which can be done from home, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics. For Asians and white, this is 30% or above, but for Blacks and Hispanic, it's below 20%. Similarly, educational attainment of the workers have significant impact on their ability to work from home. If you have less than high school, it is only 4.2%. Or if you have college graduates, you hold jobs which can be done at home, 51.9% of the cases. There's a gender differences as well. According to census, women working full-time year-round are more likely to have a bachelor degree than men and hold jobs which can be done at home at higher percentage than men. Women, however, during COVID-19 are dropping out of workforce at a higher percentage. It is attributed to reasons like caregiving to elders, childcare availability, remote learning of kids, and believe me not, how the low priority for workspace at home. Men, kids, and then women in the family get the prime space to work. Some things never change. Next, please. This recession is not your grandfather or your father's recession. Current COVID-19 recession is quite different than previous recession of 1990, 2001, and 2008, which impacted the top 25% income earners and bottom 25% income earners at the same rate. During COVID, it is vastly different. The top 25% whose jobs can be done remotely have bounced back nicely, but the bottom 25% working at restaurants, hotels, and others have experienced a job loss of more than 20%. Next, please. The question is this is a new normal or not? A great number of companies such as Microsoft, Facebook, and our hometown company Target has announced work from home till at least middle of 2021. It will be 15 months or more of work from home. Maybe it will become a habit, maybe new culture. What we know, thousands of bank branches are closing for good. Telemedicine is approved for reimbursement by Medicare. Zoom is a verb, and the iPhone has 5G. I believe it will not be 2019 anymore. Recently, the Fed chair has stated the pandemic has accelerated existing trends in the economy and society, including the use of technology, telework, and automation. This will have lasting effect on how people live and work. Next, please. So never let a crisis go to waste. System and people have the ability to adapt when they are faced with crisis. Disruption provides a window of opportunity to elicit sustainable changes to the system if thoughtful nudges are implemented. Transportation history tells us that the government is very reluctant to and faces a strong pressure to restore the status quo. After 35W bridge collapse and loss of significant highway capacity, drivers quickly adapted to alternate route. After the replacement bridge with larger capacity opened in 14 months, most of the traffic returned. Things were somehow different during and after 1973 oil embargo, which lasted for only 6 months. But the effects were rather long-term. Vehicle efficiency effort started resulting in CAFE standards, which continue to this date. The speed limit was reduced to 55 mph on the interstate, which lasted till 1995. This resulted in reduction in per capita fatalities, highest in the history of USA between 1973 and 74. Gas consumption was reduced and air quality was improved. I believe if we want to sustain the transportation environmental gains caused by COVID crisis, we need to study what changes are happening. We need to partner with and encourage those individuals and organizations which are already thinking about making long-term changes. We have to strategize how we can encourage others less inclined to make desirable changes. We have already seen that low-income minority communities and women are disproportionately negatively impacted as they have less ability to change or have limited transportation options. We need to develop policy options so that we do not leave anyone behind and create an even wider gap between have and have not. I believe we should revisit the justification behind highway capacity improvement projects to see whether those projects are still needed. We should also need to figure out how to meet the mobility requirement of disadvantaged communities, especially the transit. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Lari. That was very, very insightful, and I appreciated very much your comments on equity. We'll be taking a little bit more of an in-depth look at transportation and equity issues in a couple of weeks, but I'm glad that you mentioned that. Our final speaker before we get into our committee questions and answers is Lee Munich, and Lee also comes to us from the state and local policy program. I thought we would conclude our series of presentations from the university with some issues related to transportation finance. After all, members, among many of our charges for this committee, one of the most important is that we craft a finance bill for the biennium. And so I thought we would again conclude with some thoughts from Mr. Munich about where we head from here. Again, given the fact that this isn't like any other biennium we faced, really, certainly in our legislative careers, from those that are on this committee in terms of the dual crises, the several simultaneous crises that we face. So how does this impact finance? Mr. Munich, thank you so much for your participation with us over many, many years. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Chairman Hornstein. My name is Lee Munich, and I'm a senior researcher at the Humphrey School of State and Local Policy Program. I'm going to talk briefly about sort of two emerging issues in finance. Obviously, there's a lot of detail to master, and we've been doing research at the Humphrey School to try to develop a better database on the Minnesota finance system and all the different parts of it and be able to analyze it. But I want to talk about two trends that I think are have started before COVID, but if anything, are probably going to be more important in the future. The first one is related to user-based alternative to the fuel tax. We've been using different terms for this. Currently, we're just calling them distance-based fees, but they're also known as mileage-based user fees, road usage charges, or vehicle miles traveled fees. But they're all the same thing. And basically, as the fuel tax becomes less effective and equitable with more fuel-efficient and electric vehicles, as we've talked about, an alternative user-based approach is needed, and distance-based fees offer this. There's been a lot going on in the last few years. This is just a couple of maps that show the states that have completed pilots or are planning pilots, states that are monitoring the issue, and there's also states that are looking at if we move to these types of distance-based fees, how are we going to operate between states? A lot of this has been going on in the West Coast, and Oregon sort of led the way, and Washington and California have been quite busy on it. There's also been activity on the East Coast, not as much in the Midwest, although Minnesota has a long has been involved in this for quite a while. As you can see, there's also coalitions that have emerged. The Western RUC Consortium, as they refer to it, where not all of these states have pilots, but they're all sort of monitoring this and looking at how this might go forward. And then there's the I-95 Corridor Coalition on the East Coast that has been working together to look at some of the implications of mileage-based fees. We've had some conversations with MnDOT and the MASTO, the Midwestern group, about some sort of a coalition in the Midwest to look at this, but that's still evolving. Minnesota has actually been a national leader on distance-based fees, starting with former Representative Bernie Leader, who proposed a mileage-based user fee at the gas pump back in the 1990s. Legislature in 2008 approved and funded a pilot study by MnDOT to look at some of the emerging technologies and how this might work if it were to be implemented, and also established a mileage-based user fee policy task force, which Chair Hornstein was involved with, as well as Representative Elkins before he was in the legislature. They basically concluded two things. They looked at all aspects of it and came up with a number of recommendations as to how this might move forward. One was to promote equity to ensure that all motorists pay for their share fair use of the road transportation system, regardless of the vehicle energy source. And then, of course, to generate transportation funds and to generate revenue by supplementing or replacing the motor fuel tax with mileage-based user fees over time. So this is not like flipping the switch off and on. We're probably going to have the gas tax for a long time into the future, but as it becomes less viable and less equitable because of different types of vehicles, there needs to be a different approach that's user-based, and that's led to this. The federal government has transportation funding alternative grants that have funded many of these state projects, including MnDOT's study, kind of looking more into the future of in-vehicle technology, telematics, to collect distance-based fees. They've been working with car sharing companies in order to test this and working with the revenue department, kind of see, is there a, you know, less expensive way of collecting this data by just using the telematics that is going to be in the car in the future. I just want to highlight one particular state that's moved very quickly on this recently. Utah, through their legislature, decided that they wanted to implement a road user charge for electric plug-in hybrids and hybrid vehicles to pay their annual flat fee. You know, it's always a question of how you transition. This is, Utah says this is just kind of the first step, but what they've done is they've set up annual flat fee schedule for these three types of vehicles. And then they offer as a voluntary alternative, people being able to pay a mileage fee, but they wouldn't ever pay more than they're paying on this annual flat fee. So it's a way of sort of introducing this, getting people accustomed to it, dealing with some of the technology issues and concerns that people might have. And they've been moving quickly on that. This is just a chart showing Utah's road usage charge program enrollment. You know, it's small numbers, although Utah is not a huge state, but they you can see that there are already take up on this, including telematics, where the company is actually, that's providing the telematics, is actually collecting the fee and transmitting the revenue to the transportation department. The second issue I want to talk about is public-private partnerships. Now, this is an issue that's been with us for some time, but it's it is being used by many states and has a potential of making more effective use of the private sector in investments in transportation by sharing some of the risks, the degree of ownership, integration, and using private financing. This is just a chart that shows a couple of the differences. Conventional projects basically would rely on the public sector to take all the risks, except for the construction. Whereas P3 projects would have the public and private sector sharing more of the risk. Public financing would fund the conventional projects, whereas private financing could be brought in to fund these P3 projects. A conventional project would rely on the lowest bidder. P3 projects would look for the best suited, best value project. And then under conventional projects, operation and maintenance would be carried out by the public agency once it's constructed. But under a P3 project, the O&M could be carried out by the private sector, and ongoing rehabilitation and can be overseen by the public sector with the stewardship of the P3 agreement. So this just shows some of the states that have already set up P3 concessions. The chart on the left shows where it's been used to build new facilities. On the chart on the right is a bit more limited. This is where you would have an existing toll facility where they've been converted to private concessions. So this kind of a quick overview of those two topics that I know that there's interest in these by the members, and so I'd be open to any questions.
Thank you so much. What a great presentation, and all of you today, so insightful. We have about 12 minutes left for member questions, and I have two on the list so far, and in this order, we'll first hear from Representative Elkins and then Representative Cagle. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, so I just wanted to serve, I will have a bill on this modeled after the Utah program. It's stuck in the revisor's office logjam. But it would establish a road user charge on electric vehicles only, and talking with the folks in Utah from a complexity standpoint, they wish they had left the hybrids out just for sake of initial implementation ability. And anticipating that we would make use of the same infrastructure that is being used right now in Oregon, Washington, and Utah, all of those, in all three of those states, they're using a third-party administrator who keeps the data. So the government never gets its hands on it. The data is largely being collected from the plugins into the diagnostic ports, and all you're collecting is the odometer reading, so there's not really any locational data privacy issues. And it's working already in all of those states. They're all using the same third-party administrator, a toll company called Emovis. That system has already been integrated with Fast Enterprise's vehicle registration systems, the same one we now use in all three of those states. So the technical platform to be able to do an initial pilot is already proven. As soon as we have the bill out, liberated from the revisor's office and introduced, we'll have further discussions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Elkins, for that preview. And of course, we'll be hearing a lot more about your bill, a lot more about electric vehicles as we move forward. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just really interested in this last mile delivery piece, how our Amazon habits have affected, I guess, our local roads, and was just kind of curious about what kind of policy changes you would anticipate seeing that might make a big difference when it comes to the stress on our transportation system due to our online shopping addiction.
And I think that would be a question for Professor Natarajan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cagle. So that's a really interesting question. And I think because of COVID, I think, you know, what's happening is we are past that point of like, we are going to go into this online shopping world. So that is going to increase our last mile deliveries for sure. But I think what we can do from our side is we can offset some of those emissions by having some of those technology-enabled solutions. So I think that's going to be the future, I think, in terms of the trade-off between having more home deliveries versus offsetting those emissions by having electric vehicles and other driverless technologies. My sense is that we will not go back to a less online world, but I think because of more sustainable technologies, I think there is enough scope for balancing out those emissions. So that's my sense.
And is there any thought to, thank you, Mr. Chair, is there any thought to coordinating deliveries? Because, that's one thing that, I can order three things off of Amazon, all set to be delivered the same day, and I get one UPS, one USPS, and one from the Prime truck. And so just curious if there's any kind of public policy initiatives that we can try to push that would help with the coordination of logistics on those issues.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I think that's a great idea, and I think that's where we need to move our policies. This is also happening in other spaces. So for example, in the healthcare space, what they're trying to do is rather than each nonprofit organization going and doing audits, they're trying to coordinate the audits so that there is less fatigue on the recipients, right? So I think similarly, I think there is definitely scope for us to coordinate this last piece so that the same house is not visited by, you know, the UPS truck, FedEx truck, and then USPS truck three times a day, right? So I think there is definitely scope for policy in that space. Thank you.
Thank you. So our last two questions for the day from committee members are from Representative Petersburg and Representative Mason. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, one for Professor Natarajan and one for Professor Lari. The first one to Professor Natarajan is in regards to your linkage from farmers to market. One of the things that I noticed was you made the correlation that there was issues with transportation linkages from whether it's going to a distributor or to other markets. But the reality is that, and the question I ask is, how much did you take into consideration the fact that that was a one-time event because of the implications of COVID? For example, our hog farmers down in greater Minnesota could get their hogs to market, not because of transportation issues, but because COVID actually closed down their plants and they had no place to process them. And so the question is, is, are we making determinations based upon a one-time thing that was artificially induced because of government controls, or are they truly something that's there? That's the first question. The second question for Professor Lowry was in regards to his comparison between the oil embargo and the I-35 bridge collapse. Was not the differences in the fact that they were two prospects or two problems, but because the oil embargo required and developed government regulations to actually change people's perspective, whereas with I-35, it allowed the public to actually impact their own decisions. Certainly that has to make a big difference in how we react to various problems like this. So just your comments, and then I'll be quiet. Thank you.
Thank you, and if we could have just the answers very quick, because I want to make sure that Representative Mason gets her question in before 2:30. Let's start with Professor Natarajan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Petersburg. So I think your question is very valid in terms of, you know, how much of this is one time versus how much of this is long term. My sense is that a majority or a big portion of this is going to be one-term effects. But at the same time, there are trends that we are seeing in the survey of farmers. So there is a report out there that talks about how farmers actually went to online channels, connecting directly to customers. So I think that is a new linkage for the farmers. And that will not be addressed by the existing transportation linkages. So that's where I was making this comment about we need to strengthen existing linkages, but also we need to think about opening new linkages for farmers because they are connecting to a different audience because of the pandemic. And some of that is likely to stick even after COVID-19. So thank you.
And Mr. Lowry, very quickly, and I think that's probably a complicated question to answer just in a minute or so, but I would encourage you and Representative Petersburg to continue your conversation online, and we can even post some of it potentially on our website here. But Mr. Lowry, quickly.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Petersburg. Now, you are right that those two are a little bit different, but there could have been opportunity to continue those things in 35W bridge as well.
Thank you. And our last question is from Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this is a follow-up on the chart that showed the arrows going between the farmers and the final destination. And it's been mentioned already that part of the deal last year was the fact that the COVID or meat processing plants were closed down. And I guess my question is that the main reason for the change? Or is it that people are eating more at home? Is there really a difference in the amount of food coming from the farmers to the, the final consumer?
It's a good question, Representative Mason. And thank you, Representative Natarajan. I think you've teed up some really important questions for us to consider in the agricultural sector and how that relates to transportation, which is actually very key to the state of Minnesota. Professor Natarajan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mason. So some of that change is coming because of changes in the food supply chains. So our supply chains that go to restaurants is very different from the supply chains that go to our grocery stores. And because we are seeing a shift in the demand between these two channels, we will need to think about realigning some of those networks as well. Because we have a separate transportation capacity and linkages in our food service supply chains. And then there is a different set of capacities and linkages in our supply chains that serve to our grocery stores. And because demand is realigning between these two channels, we need to think about realigning the transportation networks themselves in terms of capacities, transportation modes, and things like that.
Thank you so much, Professor Natarajan. And as we conclude today, I just, again, my heartfelt thanks to all of our guests from the University of Minnesota. This was really a great way to start us off in our deliberations this year. Many, many thought-provoking and interesting and important issues that you have all raised. And members, if you think of some other questions here moving forward in the next few days, please pass those on to me or Mr. Howe, and our guests have graciously agreed to answer your questions via email, and they will do that. So again, so appreciated. Just again, a reminder that we'll be meeting on Thursday at our usual time, 1 o'clock. We will have speakers from different agencies that this committee has jurisdiction over. We'll continue our conversation about the impacts of COVID and transportation issues and public transit issues moving forward. And that is on Thursday. With that, this committee is adjourned. Thank you very much, members.